It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we learn how to find and compare nursing homes and resources available to guide families along this journey. And thanks to a listener's suggestion on this one, seeking guidance on how to find a facility and cover costs, questions to ask, what to do when expectations are not being met. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kim Marhaney is Ombudsman Services Supervisor for the Wisconsin Board on Aging and Long-Term Care. Kim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so very much.
Good morning. We also have Otis Woods here, Administrator for the Division of Quality Assurance at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And this division licenses and regulates adult family homes, community-based residential facilities, and residential care apartment complexes. Otis, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. So, Otis, let us walk in your shoes, if we could. How does the State Health Department's Division of Quality Assurance, your division, measure quality in long-term care facilities, in nursing homes?
First of all, nursing homes in our state are primarily licensed first by our division, the Division of Quality Assurance, and that's the license to do business as the nursing homes. And those nursing homes who choose to admit individuals whose service is going to be paid for by Medicare and Medicaid have to follow additional requirements. In doing so, they have to file information with the federal government that then produces what the federal government calls quality measures. And it's those quality measures that are monitored on an ongoing basis, not only by the Division of Quality Assurance, but by the federal government. The CMS website, Care Compare, so it's www.cms.gov, Care Compare, will provide information, a bevy of information to consumers on nursing homes, the quality measures. There's a simple guide that consumers can look at to see what the quality measures means and then how to evaluate the nursing homes that they are considering and looking at those quality measures.
Yes, and I was going to just pause here with the acronym CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Carry on.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
But yes, and included at this site is a publication, Find Healthcare Providers, Compare Care Near You. So it provides a wealth of information for consumers to access to look at how a nursing home fares in terms of a number of quality measures that may be of interest to individuals who are considering a facility for their loved one.
And Kim, how do state ombudsmen enter this picture and ensure quality of care for people living in these facilities?
Well, thanks for that question, Kate. It's a really important one. From the ombudsman perspective, we would measure quality by the expectations of those residents who live in long-term care settings and all of the people who support them, their family members, their clergy people, their community advocates, as well as the staff who work in those buildings as well, who are oftentimes great advocates for the people who live there. Our 17 ombudsmen serve all of the long-term care settings in the state, which I think, Otis, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's well over 6,000 at this point, as well as persons who are over 60 who receive their home and community-based services through Family Care and IRIS. So we've got a really large footprint with very few people in the state, but we rely very heavily on that feedback that we get from those persons living in those settings.
Otis, you know, as you look at what families have to navigate, are there enough resources to help people through this really complicated and sensitive journey to put a loved one in the best place for them?
Yes, it is. And it is one of the most critical decisions that family members will make. Nursing homes provide long-term care, which is services for individuals that cannot continue to reside in their own homes or in their apartments. And then they also provide what's called short-term rehabilitation. When someone is discharged from a hospital to a nursing home and stay for a short period, that nursing home provides those critical services to help the individual recover. So when selecting a nursing home, there are a number of resources. And the first of which I'd like to have individuals contact is the Aging and Disability resource centers in their county, or ADRCs. They provide consultation, connection to resources that families can obtain when considering which nursing home they want to place their loved one in. Other resources that they can contact, there's Kim's area with the Board on Aging and Long-Term Care, and I'll let Kim go into their services, as well as local clergy who have members of their parishes who may have been in a nursing home and can, by virtue of visiting those nursing homes, provide valuable information. The last thing that I would advise family members to do, in addition to the accessing these resources, is really try to make a visit to those facilities. They'll get a good indication on the staffing, the overall environment within the nursing homes. And facilities that welcome the family visit, because this is a place that may end up being a long-term placement for their loved one. But primarily, really, try and seek as many resources as you can before ultimately making the decision on which nursing home is right for your loved one.
Otis Woods with us, leading quality assurance at the State Health Department, and Kim Marhaney with the State Ombudsman Program supporting long-term care, as we look at how to find the right nursing home for a loved one. You can join in with your questions, your experiences. They're welcome at 800-642-1234. Kim, you talk about having your ear to the ground on what it is like within these homes. There are staffing constraints, and I want Otis to speak to this as well. But, last year, a statewide survey found about one out of every five caregiver positions were vacant. How are staffing shortages affecting quality of care?
Yeah, that certainly is an impact that crosses every single aspect of long-term care. And we find a real variety of creative solutions to trying to bolster staffing. And quite honestly, we hear at the Board on Aging and Long-Term Care from some residents and family members who are trying to also play a role in that. So family members tell us at times that they're volunteering within a facility, for example. They're helping with things like making beds or helping with social programs, or if they can be trained to do so, to be able to help out maybe to clean tables and so forth, like to bus tables mm-hmm. in a resident's dining room after meals. So we hear all kinds of ways from families and residents how they would like to participate to try to free up staff if they can, to be able to do those most important and specially skilled parts of care. We encourage residents and families to form resident and family councils, to be their own best self advocates. We also have a volunteer ombudsman program in nursing homes in parts of the state, where our volunteers go in and also talk to residents and families about their experience in that nursing home, what's working, so that we can spread that along as we talk to other providers and other residents. I know that the state is running, for example, right now at an expansion on the WISC Caregiver Careers Program, and you can go to the DHS website to see more information about that. But we're seeing a bit of an influx, I think, of retired healthcare workers who might be coming into the field. We'd love it if they would come into long-term care, where those citizens of our communities really need those supports and services the most.
Otis, what are you seeing on the front lines of staffing there and quality assurance? Also, I'm noting here that the governor's budget is trying to make inroads in the next budget on this issue. Go ahead.
Excellent. That's what I was going to start. Governor Evers' budget includes a significant investment and expansion of what Kim had just mentioned, the Wisconsin WISC Caregivers Careers Program, to augment the number of certified nursing assistants in our nursing homes. During the pandemic, we have noticed that the staffing issues have been exacerbated. Individuals are not coming into the field at the level that we would hope. That's resulting in nursing homes having to make decisions on not admitting people from hospitals or from their own living arrangements. And that's putting more and more pressure on those employees that are already there. So it's becoming a balancing point for the facilities. Many are doing a fantastic job of serving the individuals who are within their settings. And it's unfortunate because without staffing, the level of services cannot be delivered as the nursing homes would plan. And so that's having an impact throughout the healthcare delivery system. Nursing homes are a critical resource for individuals who, for instance, need post-hospital care. But if there's resources or beds are not available because nursing homes are not able to bring on the staff, then you have individuals that may have to stay in the hospital a little bit longer until a resource or bed becomes available. So staffing has been a huge issue. The department continues to work with the Nursing Home Trade Associations to expand the WISC Caregiver Careers Program by offering incentives, sign-on bonuses, mentor bonuses, to encourage and incentivize individuals to choose long-term care as a career option. Our partners in our Medicaid division have announced an additional expansion of resources, not only for nursing homes, but throughout the caregiving world, if you will, to help recruit and retain individuals that ultimately may become the certified nursing assistants that we sorely need.
I'm going to pause right there. Otis Woods, Administrator in the Division of Quality Assurance for the State Department of Health. Kim Marhaney here with the Wisconsin Board on Aging and Long-Term Care. Calling with questions, what's on your mind about long-term care? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With thousands of nursing homes in our country, we get tips on how to choose quality care. Call in with questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Wisconsin Board on Aging and Long-Term Care Ombudsman Services Supervisor Kim Marhaney, overseeing the regional ombudsman serving all of Wisconsin, and DHS's Division Administrator for Quality Assurance, Otis Woods. So, Kim, what is your advice for families trying to not only find the right nursing home, but also decide once they see how the quality assurance reports have come out, or nursing home complaints, or various violations? How do you digest that and think through that?
Well, as Otis said, it is a really important decision, and I encourage family members and residents who think they will be moving into a long-term care setting to start to plan ahead, moving into a nursing home or an assisted living community. Take some time in planning. You need to be a well-informed consumer. You need to make a decision based on more than just how a certain setting looks, but how does it meet your needs? As Otis had indicated, I tell people to visit a couple of times. Have that first visit with a staff who can answer all of your questions, so that you are sure that where you're moving into meets your needs and your preferences, as well as you being a good fit for that community also. Find out, you know, can you come and go as you wish? If you're a driver, can you keep your car there? Do they have underground parking if that's important to you? Can you garden? Can you stay up late? Can you eat out? What are the social opportunities for moving into a particular setting? And then also know what you need. Wisconsin is really unique in that we have a lot of options, particularly in assisted living communities. But those options are all very different in terms of what they offer. Hmm. One big concern that we hear at the Board on Aging is that some persons move into assisted living, for example, and don't understand that assisted living doesn't necessarily require there to be a licensed or registered nurse on staff. And so if their family member has medical needs, sometimes that can be a point of friction if the staff isn't well prepared to meet those needs. And if in fact that individual might do better in a nursing home or a different setting that does employ licensed staff. So you need to be able to ask those questions. We also advise that you try to have that opportunity to review the documents that you'll sign before you move in so that you know what you're committing to. If you know that your financial resources are limited, then you should be able to know whether you can stay in that setting if you need to go to family care or medical assistance. In a nursing home, medical assistance is broadly accepted, whereas some assisted living communities are not able to care for people in the medical assistance or the family care program. So you need to know what those payment options might be as well, or those requirements by that provider. Long-term care insurance may or may not pay for your stay in a long-term care setting. Every policy is different. We have a Medigap helpline at the Board on Aging and Long-Term Care who can oftentimes answer questions about long-term care insurance policies as well. And then finally, once you do move in, if you find that you're not satisfied, speak up. Have a respectful conversation with the home's management. Find people you trust there. Call an ombudsman, call the Board on Aging before you need us, before what might be maybe a minor concern turns into a bigger complaint.
Be vocal.
So that we can.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just want to jump in here with Otis, because I think that we might not understand what goes into these inspections, these reports, the follow-ups. But we also see the data that comes out from the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and also the newsroom ProPublica estimating about one in every three of our state's nursing facilities have serious deficiencies. How do you go about investigating complaints, and what can you tell us about these violations?
Okay, excuse me. So when we receive a concern that's raised by anyone, and there we have a variety of ways to receive them, both online, direct 800 numbers, our staff that are very busy lately receiving them, go through an evaluation, determine the seriousness of those, and then that will help us determine how quickly we need to go out and conduct an investigation or review of those. The earliest time frame we will go out is within 3 days. Something that is so serious that someone's health is compromised. And when that happens, we'll go out and since it's a targeted review, we're looking specifically at the nature of the issues that's been referred to us. If we confirm that the issues exist and there are violations, we will issue the report to the nursing home, and they have a shortened period of time to give us what's called a corrective action plan. All that said and done, it's all in. We require them to be corrected within a period of time. We and the federal government require them to be corrected. Once that information is done, we post it as soon as we can, generally within a couple of weeks on our website. Provider search that the consumer can then go in and see what the results have been. After that report has been issued, then we will go in within a 4 to 5 week time frame to conduct what's called a verification or revisit to see, did they correct the issue that was found to be not in compliance? And if not, why not? And if there are additional violations, we would serve them. If for very serious ones, there's a real shortened time frame within which nursing homes have to correct them, because they are so serious that they impact an individual's health and safety.
It is very busy. I want to pick up on that word busy, because you said that you've got calls coming in. Your staff is very busy with these possible violations, with things happening in facilities. Is this unusual amount of traffic here? Could it also possibly be related to staffing?
It is unusual. We compare the data from the pre-pandemic years to the current in the middle of the pandemic, or nearly the end of the pandemic, and there has been a substantial rise in the number of complaints our agency is receiving, not from a variety of sources, including Kim's area, and it does show that their staffing has become a concern, and when that happens, we try and get out there as quickly as we can. And when the reports are issued, make sure the corrective action plan addresses the issue. Now, with regard to staffing, it may be that a nursing home may have to stop admitting individuals because of the staffing issues. Mm. And that's what we would encourage, because you don't want to bring someone in the midst of a crisis that is related to staffing. So we highly encourage them to really stop admitting until you take care of this. And then once things are settled down, then resume admissions. But yes, it's pointing to a lot of staffing concerns that everybody is aware of. And so we're trying to work across the stakeholder communities to see what we can do to bring on additional staffing in these settings, because they are, again, sorely needed.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Kate.
Thank you for having me.
Otis Woods, Division Administrator at the State Department of Health Services on Quality Assurance, Kim Marhaini with the Board on Aging and Long-Term Care. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a pair of stories about Good Samaritans.
We're living in a time when things feel so polarized. Us versus them. I'm right, you're wrong. But writer and cardiologist Dr. R.F. Ahmed of Madison wants to remind people there's so much good in the world and that we should take care of one another. He shares two writings about Good Samaritans in his life.
My Jesus Moment, May 2020. A routine plays out at my place of work year after year. I call it my Jesus Moment. Every year, I fast during Ramadan. For those not sure, this is a Muslim tradition of no eating or drinking from pre-dawn to sunset for a month straight. It is a spiritual and physical cleansing and reckoning of sorts. Kathy, a colleague of mine, is an excellent pastry chef, a baker par excellence. That she is Christian and married to a pastor adds a little more oomph to this storyline. For years now, I would do the fasting and Kathy would bake a cake and other confectionery for the department to celebrate the end of Ramadan. I bear the brunt for the good of many. My Jesus Moment. We get a laugh out of it. Even more, in the world of today, I derive hope out of this. A gift early in the pandemic, April 2020. A world in lockdown, I step out every day to fight an enemy I cannot see. I arm myself by giving to those worse hit than me. I wear my destiny and well wishes and acts of kindness such as these. A gift of hand-sewn caps and masks from my neighbor, thank you, Bonnie Kenzie.
R.F. Ahmed shared his writings about Good Samaritans in Wisconsin. He also told me why he wanted to pair those stories together.
It is my observation that places where people treat each other well, those nations, communities, and places generally are doing well, and vice versa. Places, nations, communities where people mistreat each other, abuse each other, are not doing so well. So I can extend this a little further. And all religions talk about being a good Samaritan and being rewarded for that. And for abusers, there's punishment. And then when I look around, I see this happening in real time where places with more good Samaritan are getting rewarded and places with more abusers are getting punished. And this, to me, is a sign that God is.
Why do you think it's important to share stories about kindness?
I believe because kindness plays into our happiness. Optimism plays into our mental and physical well-being. And I think it is critical to bring about more of those subjects. One of my writings in the book is actually a critique on the news, which I sometimes feel takes the negative perspective and puts it above the positive take. So I think the positive take, this is the best of America for you in these readings, and I wanted to lay it out.
Dr. Arif Ahmed is a writer and cardiologist from Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the inaugural World Premiere Wisconsin Festival, highlighting the state's original plays and musicals with over 40 productions being staged. Call in with questions about live theater, original works in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jen Uphoff-Gray is Artistic Director of Forward Theater Company in Madison and founded World Premiere Wisconsin. Jen, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Well, this World Premiere Wisconsin highlighting plays and musicals all over our state, this is 4 years in the making. How strong would you say is Wisconsin's theater scene?
Well, I think Wisconsin's theater scene has been strong for decades. Of course, there's ebbs and flows, you know, depending on what's going on in the world and in the field. But it's always been a tremendous point of pride for me as a theater professional who grew up in this state. I did go away for quite a few years to work on the East Coast, but came back in 2005 and was blown away all over again by the caliber of work that is staged here and of new works that are created here. And one of the goals in founding World Premiere Wisconsin was to try to get a little more attention shown nationally on the beautiful artists and the beautiful work that's happening here in our state.
Right, because from the outside looking in, I mean, from my perspective, when I scroll through all of these productions, I think to myself, wow, theater here is like more than the sum of your parts. Like, if you put on all of these individually, but collectively, this is really strong. This is really interesting. Can you explain how World Premiere Wisconsin works?
Sure. So basically, World Premiere Wisconsin is sort of an umbrella idea that there would be this period of time. And for this inaugural festival, that period runs from March 1st. It started a little over a month ago till June 30th. But years ago, we started reaching out to theater companies all over the state, started with our big sort of flagship professional companies, and then connected with educational theaters, community theaters, youth theaters, all of the above, and said, we invite your company in part of your, you know, regular programming to mount a premiere of a brand new work. And if you can do it during this 4 month period, you're part of this festival and we can help market it. We can provide, you know, support and resources, colleagues to work with. You know, some of the companies participating do new works all the time. I think of Northern Sky in Door County or Milwaukee Rep. Some of these companies, I think, are doing their very first ever world premiere. And by doing this collectively, we like to think that we're sort of supporting everybody and making it just a little bit easier and a little less risky to take on something new.
Were you surprised by a number of stages that took you up?
I wouldn't say I'm surprised because I just know how broad and sort of game for a challenge Wisconsin theater makers are. But I will say, I think all of us involved in World Premiere Wisconsin are incredibly proud that this festival, it's living up to our big aspirations for it.
Last time we talked, last fall, you had so many concerns about theater staff migrating away from the industry and also so much inflationary pressures hitting theater companies. What is it like now?
I wouldn't say that it's better overall. It's changed. I'm seeing less attrition from the field in terms of people saying, I don't want to work in theater anymore. We seem to have leveled off as far as that goes. But what has happened, and particularly in the last couple of weeks, is you are seeing some major theater institutions around the country either closing or announcing that they are on the precipice of closing if they don't receive some massive financial support in the very short term. You know, as we talked about last fall, theaters are just all in this situation where our costs are way up and revenues are rebuilding, but still rebuilding. Revenues have not caught up to expenses for pretty much anybody. And the government support that kind of helped close that gap during the peak of the pandemic is now gone. So I think now what you're seeing is some people in the field who are being forced out by the closure of companies. We had a very close scare with Milwaukee Chamber Theater earlier this spring that you know announced that they were on the precipice of closing. They fortunately had a very successful fundraising campaign to allow them to hang on, but it's a scary time. And I continue to say what I said last fall, which is that if you value your local theater, please subscribe, buy some tickets, you know, show up for us, and we will be here for you in the long run.
Let's talk about some themes that have emerged from these original works that are surfacing all over our state through this festival. Are they drawing on current events? What are they drawing from to create these productions?
Well, I think anytime you produce a world premiere, you are almost inevitably producing a story that is commenting in some way on the world that we live in. I mean, that's the joy of working with a living writer who's living in the same world that the rest of us are.
Makes sense.
The same time is that whether it's a play that is set in the 1400s or the 1900s or the future, the themes of the play are going to be looking at what's going on in our world. And I think we're seeing that interpreted in so many exciting different ways. There have been beautiful pieces that I got to see back in March when they're opening. There are things coming up ahead that I can't wait to see. But all of them make me look at the community I live in and the country I live in different ways. And that's kind of the joy of doing brand new work.
Well, here's one that's perhaps near and dear to your heart or taking some of your time. You're directing Tonight Artemisia, debuting at Forward Theater. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So Artemisia is a world premiere play that we commissioned from most produced playwright in America currently, Lauren Gunderson. We've done some of her work before at Forward, and she is a dream of a playwright to work with. Artemisia looks at the story of Artemisia Gentileschi, the most famous female playwright in 17th century Europe. She had a very dramatic and fascinating life and was famed in her own time. And then, like so many women artists do, was sort of disappeared into history. And she's now, in the last few decades, been having a real resurgence as scholars and historians, you know, recognize the brilliance of her work as well as the dynamism of the way she lived her life. And so Artemisia, which opens tonight at the Overture Center, is this incredible story of humor and heart and heartbreak and romance and just an extraordinary defiant woman.
Oh, it sounds really fascinating. And someone from the past who we don't know their story about, or many don't, that too must be really interesting to dig into.
Oh, it's great. Well, whenever you work on a play as a director or an actor or playwright, you become a very quick expert on the topic of whatever it is, maybe dangerously so in the amount of information that we have. This has been a beautiful world for us to inhabit over the last month, and we are so thrilled to be able to now share it with an audience. And the Madison audience here is going to get to see it first before this play goes off to have what I am confident will be an illustrious and successful life at theaters all over the country.
Wow. Forward Theater Artistic Director Jen Upoff-Gray founded this new theater experience in Wisconsin. Dozens of original works are part of World Premiere Wisconsin that is underway. Call in with questions about live theater or how you're involved in stage works. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.
There are winds.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is The Rebel Girl, written by labor activist Joe Hill over a century ago and performed by Hazel Dickens. It's a musical honoring Hill's legacy. Opens next week at UW Oshkosh, part of a statewide festival highlighting Wisconsin's theater productions. The number to talk with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jen Uphoff-Gray founded this world premiere Wisconsin festival and stays with us. Jen, let's talk about A Song of Protest Opens, this play about Joe Hill. Who is Joe Hill?
Yeah, so this is a production, Joe Hill, A Song of Protest, which is coming up next weekend as a co-production between UW Oshkosh and Fond du Lac Theater. So as a person who grew up with very labor activist parents, I know that Joe Hill was, you know, someone who gave, you know, voice to the voiceless, right? And I'm so thrilled that this academic theater, this community theater are partnering to debut a new piece that is going to use both song and story to examine the mystery of this really important figure in 20th century history.
So you say song and story. So it's not just the songs, but it will weave in more of who this person was in history.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Of course, I haven't seen it yet because it's brand new and it's opening next weekend. But my understanding is it's, I don't know if they're considering it a full musical or a play with music. That's a very fine line. but regardless, the folks who go see that, they're going to see a play and they're going to hear music and they're going to learn something about this really remarkable figure from history.
And then on April 27th, there is Zuri's Crown opening in Milwaukee. It's an adaptation of Rapunzel. So how is it different?
Yeah. So, you know, again, I haven't seen it yet, but it's very exciting. It's being produced by Black Arts Milwaukee, a wonderful organization in Milwaukee that's focusing on the vibrant Black community and the Black theater artists in that city. And yeah, they're taking Rapunzel and they're setting it, you know, in the neighborhood around, you know, the corner from you, featuring a mysterious woman who, as they describe it, teaches a beauty supply store owner's arrogant wife that being different should not be scary. So I mean, I can't wait. It sounds incredible, right? These first two are such great examples of the wide variety of pieces that are being brought to stages all over the state as part of this festival.
It makes me think about how do you approach diversity in the plays and agency in these stories as you put together this portfolio, if you will, of world premieres.
Yeah, well, one of the ways that happens just kind of organically is because, you know, World Premiere Wisconsin as an entity is not deciding what plays any of these theater companies are going to be producing. Each company is making their own choice of what kind of work they want to debut on their own stage. But by bringing it all together in such close proximity to each other, it's amazing how these pieces kind of speak to each other. We have a festival journalist, Mike Fisher, who's the former drama critic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the festival from the very beginning and writing these really cool blog posts that are on the World Premiere Wisconsin website and looking for ways in which different pieces seem to speak to each other, not by plan, but by, you know, zeitgeist or osmosis or however you want to define it. But it's been thrilling by reaching out to so many diverse companies representing so many diverse communities in our state. You automatically get this beautiful wide breadth of storytelling.
I appreciate how academic or university theaters are in the orbit of these private or professional companies. Like they're sharing the same type of community festival. And that to me is really interesting too, because, you know, there are students who want to make a career of it and just to have that all together and being almost on that same platform to me is really interesting as well.
It's been stunning. We had a kickoff event hosted at Ten Chimneys Foundation when we were launching the festival, you know, at the end of February. Tension Meets has been an incredible partnering sponsor for us. And we invited folks working on all of these productions for all out over the festival. And it was incredible to just be mingling in this room and see young people who are working at First Stage in Milwaukee, who are teenagers looking at building a career in professional theater, hoping maybe they could stay in Wisconsin to do it. And they are talking with, you know, Wisconsin theater royalty, like, you know, Brian Mani and Laura Gordon, and all of us coming together as colleagues in this art form. It was actually breathtaking. And as the person who kind of cooked up this festival, it kind of brought multiple tears to my eyes to see that happening.
Jen Apoff-Gray with us, founder of the inaugural festival, World Premiere Wisconsin. And as we look at the upcoming plays and what you can see through this festival, 800-642-1234. So there is Hush the Waves, premieres in Madison on the 21st, about two women struggling with teen pregnancy. What can audiences expect?
Well, that play is written by the brilliant Sam White. He was one of the artists involved in founding Forward Theater, so we know and love his work very well. He's a very experienced playwright. I know this is a very personal story for him, and he's mm-hmm. looking at these two women who are a generation apart facing this issues of pregnancy. Maybe that's relevant right now. One storyline taking place in 1948, the other in 1978, and seeing how the world around them influenced how they dealt with their personal circumstances. So I think we can expect something incredibly heartfelt, incredibly true. And if I know Sam's work at all, there will be humor as well.
Before we have to leave here, I want to give a shout out to Carthage College Theater and the mm-hmm. Kenosha Verbatim Project. That sounds really interesting, Jen.
What an amazing opportunity for the theater students at Carthage College. This is a sort of work of devised theater based on interviews and really focusing on what was going on in Kenosha after the shooting of Jacob Blake in the summer of 2020. So theater can be one of our absolute best tools for processing the things that are happening in the world around us. And for these young people to get to engage in this incredibly difficult subject matter and then use theater to try to make sense of it is, it's genius that they put this project together. And I think it's going to be super impactful.
I was reading the tagline, a play by Kenosha residents and mm-hmm. others about what happened and what happens next. I mean, mm-hmm. it really shows you how theater can contribute to a larger dialogue. Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for letting me come on and talk about this cool festival.
Jen Apoff-Gray, Artistic Director at Forward Theater Company, founded World Premiere Wisconsin Festival, highlighting Wisconsin original plays and musicals. For disclosure, Forward Theater is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have a link to the festival, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.